Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. For the past 30 years, the Arctic has been warming roughly twice as fast as other parts of the world. We have done many, many shows about the Arctic. The climate crisis has also caused a steep decline in the Arctic sea ice. According to NASA, since the late 1970s, when satellite images were first used to study the region, the extent of ice covering Arctic waters has fallen by 13% per decade. The loss of ice spells trouble for many species that depend on it for their survival, including polar bears. According to a new study from the University of Toronto Scarborough, most polar bear populations will collapse by the end of the century if the climate crisis continues at the current pace. The study is the first to offer timelines showing how Arctic sea ice loss will affect the ability of polar bears to reproduce and survive, since they will have to endure longer periods without food. According to the study's authors, there is very little chance that polar bears would persist anywhere in the world, except perhaps in the very high Arctic, in one small subpopulation, if greenhouse gas emissions continue at business as usual levels. Joining us to talk about this study and what can be done to save polar bears is Dr. Stephen Amstrup, co-author of the study. Dr. Amstrup is adjunct professor at the University of Wyoming in Laramie and chief scientist for Polar Bears International. It's the only organization dedicated solely to wild polar bears. Dr. Amstrup previously served as research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey at the Alaska Science Center, where he led polar bear research in Alaska for 30 years. Hi, Dr. Amstrup. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be on.
It's great to have you, and thank you for your work. You've worked on the issue of polar bears for over 30 years?
Yeah, I did. I was in charge of research in Alaska for 30 years, and then I've been with Polar Bears International for 10 years, so it's actually 40 years now.
Why are you so passionate about polar bears?
Well, there's a number of reasons. I mean, for one thing, they're just magnificent, magnificent animals. It's hard to really appreciate giant white bears roaming around in an environment that looks like the surface of the moon, mm-hmm. and appreciate that they're not only surviving out there, but thriving out there, or at least they were historically. Mm-hmm. And but of course, then the other side of it is that polar bears depend on an environment that's literally melting as the temperature rises. And so they are sending a message to us about the impacts that we are having, that humans are having on the world as a whole.
We've done a lot of shows about melting ice and how it will affect polar bears. Polar bears have kind of been the poster child for climate change. But this study is the first to actually offer timelines showing how sea ice loss will affect the ability of polar bears to reproduce and survive. Dr. Amstrup, can you tell us about, you know, how this study differs from others and why it is so important?
Yeah, I think that you've hit on really the most important contribution of the paper. You know, back in 2010, my colleagues and I published a paper in Nature suggesting that we could lose up to two-thirds of the world's polar bears by the middle of the century, and we might lose them all by the end of the century. But it was, there were no specific timelines involved in that. And so what we've done here in the modeling done by Dr. Peter Molnar at the University of Toronto has provided the biological or physiological underpinning for the more general relationship that we knew about between polar bears and sea ice. And what the technique is basically looking at how, knowing from historic records how fat polar bears can be, then looking at how long polar bears can fast on their energy stores, and then intersecting that information, which is basic physiology. You know, if you're only so fat, you can only survive on that fat for so long before you starve. But intersecting timelines of risk of how fat and how thin polar bears can be with projected sea ice declines. And so knowing how many days a bear can survive on its fat stores and then how many ice-free days we're going to see in the future allowed us to make these projections of when polar bears in different parts of their range are likely to start to disappear.
Can you talk about what went into actually conducting the study? How do you learn how many days a polar bear can survive, for example?
Well, this is the work that Dr. Molnar did, and I thought that he was going to be on the phone with us.
Yeah, we're trying to connect with Dr. Molnar. Hopefully he'll pick up soon.
Yeah, hopefully he will. But he looked at the animals that had been captured in Hudson Bay in Canada and looked at how fat they were when they arrived on shore before they began their fast. And then calculated through models that include all of the energetic costs that an animal faces when it's in a fasting state, and determining a range of time frames that those animals could sustain a fast. And then looking at, well, how fat is it possible for polar bears to get, and looking across the range of bears, how do they compare in fatness to bears that were assessed in Hudson Bay? And, kind of what are the thinnest bears that we see approaching a fasting period in the summertime? And that established a range of time frames, a range of numbers of ice-free days or fasting days that bears could survive.
Dr. Amstrup, let's go over just some basic information about polar bears. Since you have worked with them for 40 years and have studied them, how have their numbers changed over those decades?
Well, the global numbers are still in question because there's a number of populations across the Arctic that we just don't have good population estimates. But the populations that have been studied most closely, we actually know pretty well what the population trend is. And so, for example, in the Beaufort Sea of Alaska, where I did most of my work, and in Hudson Bay of Canada, these are population areas where, because of the changes in the sea ice, we have expected that we would see declines or impacts of climate change earliest. And in fact, we are. The population in Western Hudson Bay, for example, has declined over 30% in the last few decades. And in the Beaufort Sea of Alaska, we published a paper back in 2015. Jeff Bromagen from the USGS was the senior author of that paper. And that documented an approximately 40% decline in numbers just in the first decade of the 2000s. So we know that there's this fundamental relationship between access to ice and the ability for polar bears to catch their prey, and we are increasingly refining what that means in terms of an impact on polar bears directly.
Is any that those declines are directly related to the loss of ice? Are there any other reasons for those declines?
Well, there are other probably contributing factors, but the main thing for sure is the loss of opportunity to catch their prey. Polar bears feed basically on two species of seals that they catch from the surface of the sea ice. So you can think of the sea ice as kind of a giant dinner plate, and these seals are incredibly fat rich. So they're kind of like giant fat pills laying out there on this dinner plate of the sea ice. And it is feeding on that incredibly rich food source that has allowed polar bears to become the largest bears in the world. And when you start to take that away, there's nothing on land that can compensate for the loss of that incredibly rich food source. So the main impact by far is the loss of sea ice and the loss of the food that it makes available to the bears. But there are other things. You know, in some areas, bears continue to be hunted. And in some places, the hunting may not be in balance with the current situation of the of the population. They're probably one of the main influences that's related to the loss of sea ice, but results in an on-the-ground impact, is that now we have more bears spending more time on land, and they're hungrier than they used to be. Mm. So a lot of these animals end up going into communities, places that they've really never been before, looking for food. And oftentimes what happens is that these animals end up getting shot. Ooh. So there can be a short-term impact from this long-term effect of the loss of sea ice.
Oh, they end up getting shot?
You know, when you have large, hungry carnivores roaming around in your village, it can be a human safety issue. And, you know, I don't think very many people are very desirous of having that situation.
On your website, you offer detailed information about bears and the food they eat. An example, a polar bear can eat 100 pounds of blubber in a single sitting?
Yeah, a large male bear could do that. They, you know, one of the things, if you're a polar bear roaming around on the ice, one of the things that's really common is that an other bear might come along, smell the fact that you've just killed a seal, and come along and try and take that seal away from you. So polar bears have kind of evolved to a feast and famine diet. They get these big chunks of food, but relatively infrequently, and they've evolved to eat very rapidly. So it's almost like a vacuum cleaner when you see a hungry bear catch a seal.
Wow. We also learned that when an adult bear is in good shape, polar bears often eat only the blubber in order to build up the fat reserves they need to sustain themselves between meals, and then they leave the carcass for things like foxes, ravens, and other bears.
Yeah, and so an adult bear that doesn't need to increase its skeletal or muscular growth, the main thing it needs is energy, and that's what's in that fat. And so it doesn't need very much nitrogenous material, which is what protein is largely composed of. But the younger bears, the growing bears, certainly do need that sort of nutrition. And a big bear, an adult bear, might catch a seal and quickly eat most of the fat, but then it wanders off to try and catch another seal, whereas a younger bear that isn't quite as good a hunter yet could come along, scavenge that kill, and nourish itself with the protein that it needs to add to its own muscle mass and body growth.
Can you tell us more about the family dynamic? What happens when baby bears are born? How long do they stay? Do they stay with the mom or the dad? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, polar bears are mostly raised or entirely raised by their mother. Breeding season is in the spring. Males and females get together for a short period of time and mate. And then the female is largely on her own. And she will den in the fall of the year and provide basically a snow cave where she can give birth to her cubs. Polar bear cubs are born very small. About a pound and a half or something like that. So you can imagine a 600-pound female giving birth to a pound and a half baby. That's a pretty small ratio, you know, a pretty large ratio, actually. But there's a strategy there, is that the female bear has very little investment, very little energetic investment in those cubs at the time that they're born. And then once they're born, she feeds them this incredibly rich milk that allows them to grow very rapidly. And so they're born about the first of the year, but by the time they emerge from their dens in the spring, that's when they look like what we think of as baby bears. And they might weigh 25 or 30 pounds at that point. And then they're able to keep up with the mother when she goes out onto the sea ice to try and hunt for seals. One of the things that's also a risk to polar bears is that very reproductive process. Because these cubs are born totally defenseless, totally unable to get along on their own, disruptions to denning habitats can be a really important on-the-ground contributor to reproductive success. And in our case now, a threat to keeping as many polar bears around as we can until we stabilize the sea ice. You probably are aware that there are proposals to develop oil and gas reserves in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and other places where polar bear dens are common. And this poses an on-the-ground threat beyond the threat of the ultimate combustion of oil and gas resources.
Going back to the family dynamic, how will the loss, or how is the loss of sea ice affecting the cubs' ability to learn how to find food?
Well, the biggest impact of the loss of the sea ice is that you know, with less time on the ice to hunt for seals and with more time off of the ice living off of their fat reserves, females are carrying less energy that they can then transfer to their cubs. So a moment ago, I described how a female has relatively little investment in the cubs at the time of birth. But the big investment comes during that lactation period. And if she isn't fat enough to give those cubs enough milk, then they starve. And so what we have projected, and in fact what has been observed in different parts of the Arctic, is that the cubs, the survival of cubs after they're born is one of the most critical limitations on these animals. That a female may give birth, she may come out of a den with the cubs, but then she just can't produce enough energy for them. And if she's not very quick to catch some seals and replenish her own energy stores, the cubs will perish. She, however, has a larger body mass, more reserves. If she's not trying to feed her cubs, she might be able to survive herself. And so one of the things that our projections show is that the survival of cubs is the first thing that is going to stop. And then we have the survival of adult males is probably the next thing that'll be impacted. The survival of subadult bears, bears that are not quite sexually mature yet, maybe haven't quite learned how best to hunt. Then adult males, and then finally adult females, which typically, if they're not pregnant, will be able to carry a lot of body fat. So it's pretty much about body mass. You know, the cubs are pretty helpless if they don't have the support from their mother. And so they are the first ones to be impacted.
Right. And according to the study, again, polar bear populations will collapse by the end of the century if the climate crisis continues at the current pace. But you all found that reproduction rates are going to be hit, gosh, in the next couple of decades, right? I mean, they're already starting to lower in the Hudson Bay and Davis Strait. But when do you expect reproduction rates to really start dropping?
Well, reproductive rates in Hudson Bay and in the Beaufort Sea of Alaska and in Davis Strait already are dropping. We expect that by the middle of the century, between 2040 and 2060, that reproduction may have all but ceased in the Hudson Bay region. And, you know, we've already seen dramatic declines similarly in the Beaufort Sea of Alaska. So this is a very urgent problem. And the longer we allow the world to warm, the farther north, the farther into what are currently areas where polar bears may still be doing well, that they will stop doing well. And that's what our modeling shows, that we will see a progression of reproductive failure first, and then ultimately a survival failure of adults coming on later.
How long do the cubs stay with their moms?
Polar bear cubs are born in midwinter. They emerge from the den in the spring, and the female will typically keep her cubs with her for 2 1/3 years. And it's during that time that she nourishes them with for very rich milk, and also teaches them how to make a living out there on the sea ice. It's a tough environment out there. Once the bears figure it out, they could do quite well, and that's how they become the largest of all the bears. But getting to the point where they can do it on their own takes a while, and so it's basically 2 1/3 years in most cases that females keep their cubs with them.
Today we are speaking with Dr. Stephen Amstrup, co-author of a new study that found most polar bear populations will collapse by the end of the century if the climate crisis continues at the current pace. The study is from the University of Toronto Scarborough. Dr. Amstrup is adjunct professor at the University of Wyoming in Laramie and chief scientist for Polar Bears International, the only organization dedicated solely to wild polar bears. Dr. Amstrup has been working with and studying polar bears for 40 years. Dr. Amstrup, it's really amazing to hear you describe polar bears, the cubs, the moms. You know, most of us will only see photos of polar bears or maybe videos in documentaries. What is it actually like to see a polar bear with your own eyes in person?
Oh. You know, I saw my first polar bear in early spring of 1981. We were flying out over the ice west of the Arctic Alaska coast, and we'd been following footprints, and suddenly here was this giant bear, and it was like, holy cow, there's a real wild polar bear. And they are so incredible that I have that same feeling every bear I see. They're really amazing creatures. And to think, I mean, looking down at the environment that they live in, you'd think, how can anything live here, much less thrive here? But they do. And, of course, they're very handsome creatures. And the cubs really peg the cute meter. So they have a lot going for them. And, in fact, I think that's, you know, polar bears have, for centuries, captured the human imagination. They're a very revered species in a number of ways. And I think that's what makes them such an important messenger for or about the threats that we are creating for the world as a whole.
Mm. Yeah. What would you say to that, Dr. Amstrup, just about why this issue is so important? I mean, why people should care about the possibility of polar bears, gosh, being extinct by the year 2100.
Well, you know, if we don't get our act together and mitigate the rise, stop the rise in greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere in time to save polar bears, the world is going to be a very, very different place. You know, we are talking about possible changes that are way beyond anything that humans have endured during the times that we've faced this really stable climate of the last 10,000 years or so. And, you know, if we allow the world to continue to warm for another 20 or 30 years, we'll be in an environment that the world may not have seen for 2 or 3 million years. A very, very different environment, a climate that is not going to sustain the kind of agriculture we have now, the kind of societies that we have now. And, you know, I think that looking at polar bears and realizing that they are on the cusp of those kinds of changes, those kinds of unsustainable changes right now, should be a message to all of us.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Amstrup, co-author of the study that found most polar bear populations will collapse by the end of the century if the climate crisis continues at the current pace. And you can find articles along with the study at yourcallradio.org. And if you have some time, be sure to click on the National Geographic link, because there's some really amazing photos of polar bears and their cubs in that article. Dr. Amstrup is adjunct professor at the University University of Wyoming in Laramie and chief scientist for Polar Bears International. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show about polar bears, a new study from the University of Toronto Scarborough found that polar bear populations will collapse by the end of the century if the climate crisis continues at the current pace. This is the first study to offer specific timelines showing how Arctic sea ice loss will affect the ability of polar bears to reproduce and survive, since they have to endure longer periods without food because the ice is melting at such a rapid pace. Dr. Stephen Amstrup is co-author of the study. Dr. Amstrup is adjunct professor at the University of Wyoming in Laramie and chief scientist for Polar Bears International. Dr. Amstrup has been working with polar bears and studying them for over 40 years. Dr. Amstrup, we have a comment from Charles who says, I was doing biological surveys on land along the Beaufort Sea coast in Alaska in the late 80s. At that time, the sea ice remained solid along the coastline into late July. Now it's common for there to be more than 50 miles of open water at that time of the year. Since you have been studying polar bears for over 40 years, what has your experience been in seeing ice melting and changing?
That's one of the most profound things that I observed. If you had told me in 1980 when I first went up north that I was going to see the changes that I saw, I would have thought you were crazy. But in my early years working on polar bears on Alaska's North Slope, I could stand on the coastline of northern Alaska in the summertime and look, and typically, even at the end of the summer, I could see the sea ice just offshore. But now, it's beyond the curvature of the Earth. The caller suggested 50 miles offshore. It's hundreds of miles offshore. The most powerful telescope won't resolve it because it's around the corner. It's beyond the curvature of the Earth. And it is just unbelievable. And the impacts of that are significant. When you think specifically of polar bears in that part of the world, my work showed, typically were able to stay on the sea ice adjacent to shore all summer long, and they would feed on that productive ice over the narrow continental shelf of the Beaufort Sea. Now the sea ice is way beyond that, and the polar bears have either been forced to come ashore where there's very little to eat, or to drift out into the center of the polar basin where the water is deep and unproductive. And those bears that are offshore also are not feeding. So we have a situation that is a dramatic turnaround for those bears. And for the people who live there, it's also a really important point, because the thawing of the permafrost, houses are sinking into the tundra, falling into the ocean. It's a profound change in the ecosystem up there.
For the past 30 years, the Arctic has been warming roughly twice as fast as other parts of the world. According to NASA, since the late 70s, when the satellite images were first used to study the region, the extent of ice covering Arctic waters has fallen by 13% per decade. So, Dr. Amstrup, if the climate crisis continues at this pace, what are your expectations around sea ice?
Well, I think that most of the sea ice projections, including those from several years ago that we used in some of our earlier forecasts, project that by around the middle of the century, we will see an ice-free Arctic, in at least for some periods in the summertime. And so what that means is that there may still be some ice in the very high Arctic hugging the shorelines in some places, but that for at least some period of time by the middle of this century, and maybe earlier, maybe as early as 2040, based on some projections, the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free. Now, what's important, and we've known of those projections for quite a long time, and in fact, the projections for changes in sea ice extent have been the real basis for previous predictions of how polar bears are likely to fare. What our new study shows is we have not focused just on sea ice extent, but on how many days the ice will be absent from different areas where polar bears live. And it's that number of ice-free days, which clearly is related to the sea ice extent, but it's that number of ice-free days that is the added detail that is really critical to being able to project when polar bears might actually disappear from different parts of their current range.
So what happens to polar bears once we see ice-free summers in the Arctic?
Well, many more of them are going to starve if we allow the heating of the Earth to continue. Ultimately, they will all disappear. And, most of them, since polar bears don't have any real natural enemies, the cause of death is starvation, and starvation is not a pretty picture.
Mm. We have a question from Amy. Can you talk about the long-term impacts of an ice-free Arctic for the planet as a whole? Jet streams, ocean currents, for example.
Yeah, well, the changes in the oceanic environment are going to be huge. I've heard some people say that, let me go back a little bit. So the ice cover in the Arctic is important for stabilizing the Earth's climate as a whole. The cold water in the Arctic sinks down and then is carried through the oceanic circulation system throughout the world, basically. And so even though the Arctic is a relatively small part of the world, it's very important to maintaining the world's climate. And if we allow the Arctic to become totally ice-free, the changes in the climate and the weather that the rest of us will see living far from the Arctic are going to be enormous. But having said that, one of the things that I think people, some people at least, have a misconception about is they've said, well, if the sea ice disappears and polar bears disappear, we'll still have an ecosystem there, and maybe killer whales will replace polar bears as the apex predator. But in fact, that's quite unlikely, because along with the heating of the ocean, we're changing the ocean chemistry in really significant ways, and especially in the northern parts of the ocean and in the southern parts. The polar regions have very little ability, the ocean has very little ability to buffer the changes that are occurring. So we're going to see less oxygenation, lower oxygenation in the water column, much higher acidification, along with changing of the temperature. So we are probably going to see an Arctic environment and ultimately an oceanic environment that won't provide the food for the animals that we have come to appreciate or for ourselves, as we see a dramatic regime change across the world's oceans.
Well, that's connected to Amy's second question. Will ice-free poles lead to extinction of life? I mean, how will this affect life on Earth as we know it?
Well, life as we know it will be dramatically affected. I think that seems to be pretty clear. From the standpoint of the polar bear, we are already approaching global mean temperatures that are close to the maximum that polar bears have ever seen in their evolutionary history. Similar changes are facing all of the other species that are up there and around the world. So we will see a different world than the one that we know. If you think about global agriculture, one of the benefits of the relatively stable climate that we've had over the course of what we call the Holocene, the last 10 or 12,000 years, we've had a relatively stable climate that has allowed us to learn from our experiences of the past and predict what we're going to face in the future. And this is what has allowed farmers to know when to plant, when they can expect to harvest, what they can expect their yields to be, that sort of thing, how they can feed the world. That ability to predict what the future is based on the past is going away. And with that ability to predict comes substantial risk that, I don't think we should allow ourselves to face. We can mitigate this. There's a number of papers out there, a number of studies have shown that we can, in fact, if we get our act together as world societies, we can change the course that we're on and preserve a climate that's at least similar to the one that we've come to be accustomed to and the one that has allowed us to flourish. But we need to act quickly.
That goes to the question, and thank you for the questions, Amy. To Ruby's question, polar bears do not have lobbyists. Wouldn't it take multi-nation consensus to change our human habit of living for today and not the next 100 years? How do we get to that consensus? We change laws, right? How is that going to happen? Where is the hope?
Yeah, well, we used to say, if you are concerned about the climate crisis, you can do these individual things. You can drive less. You can turn your thermostat up in the summertime and down in the wintertime and that sort of thing. And those things are important. But right now we are at a crisis point where really there's two things that everybody needs to do. One is to go to the polling place and vote for people who are serious about preserving a future that we might want to, that we would feel comfortable leaving to our grandchildren. Politicians, policy leaders who are serious about a sustainable world going forward. And the other thing is to vote with your dollars in the marketplace and support companies and corporations that have shown that they are interested in sustainability and that they have developed or are developing sustainable business models that don't rely on the contributions of more and more greenhouse gases, more CO2 and other greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Those are the two most important things. And frankly, if we don't do that, a lot of the other things that we're really concerned about won't really matter. If we wait until the middle of the century, until polar bears have actually already winked out in several of their subpopulation areas, managers and policymakers probably won't have time to care about those polar bears because they are going to be so busy dealing with human climate refugees. Mm. We're already seeing that in many parts of the world, but it's coming at a pace and at a scale that we just can't imagine. People are not going to just stay home and starve when the land that they're on is unable to produce food for them. They will move. They will try and find a place where they can make a living, regardless of what governmental regulations might be in place to try and prevent it. And so we do need to act very quickly. Our forecast in this paper suggests that, by the 2040s, some of the southernmost populations of polar bears will be in serious risk, certainly by the 2060s. But 10 years ago, our paper Nature showed that it could take 20 to 30 years for the sea ice to stabilize once the rise of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is halted. So once we stop CO2 rise, we have a latent period of 20 to 30 years before the heat that went into the ocean is actually stabilized, and we see that reflected in whatever sea ice is left. So we really need to be acting now if we want to prevent what we are forecasting is going to occur by the middle of this century.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Stephen M. Strupp, adjunct professor at the University of Wyoming and Laramie, and chief scientist for Polar Bears International, the only organization dedicated to wild polar bears. Dr. M. Strupp has been studying polar bears for over 40 years, and he is co-author of a new study from the University of Toronto Scarborough that found most polar bear populations will collapse by the end of the century if the climate crisis continues at the current pace. Polar bear reproduction rates are already going down in the Hudson Bay and Davis Strait regions. We have an email from James who says, will the decline in the bears lead to an overabundance of seals? If so, what might be the consequences?
We don't know as much about the seals that the polar bears feed on as we do about the polar bears. You know, polar bears are very difficult to study, but at least they live on the surface of the ice. Ring seals, for example, which are the main source of food for polar bears across their range, spend almost all of their time under an ice cover. At least historically, that's what they did. And they derive much of their sustenance by feeding on the ecosystem that forms on the underside of the sea ice. If you think about sea ice, it's very different than lake ice. Most of us are familiar with what a piece of ice from a lake or a pond that freezes in the winter looks like, and it's pretty smooth on the bottom side, just like it is on the top side. The sea ice, because of the ejection of salt as the ice freezes, it creates kind of like a mini mountain range on the bottom side of the sea ice, and that little mountain range down there is the source of a great abundance of biological productivity. A recent study showed that over 80% of the carbon that enters a polar bear's body comes from the epontic or under sea ice community. Well, how does it get into the polar bear's body? It gets into the polar bear's body from the seals that are feeding on that biological productivity. So if the sea ice goes away, we suspect that it will probably have really profound impacts on the seals as well. But we don't know, we don't know enough yet to really quantify what that impact might be. Another impact of the loss of sea ice on seals is that ring seals give birth on the surface of the ice in the spring, and they create these little caves that are above the surface of the ice but below the surface of the drifting snow. So it's like creating a snow cave from the bottom side.
Wow.
And they give birth in there, and it shelters their pups from polar bear predation, for one thing. It gives them some protection from that, and also from the elements. But if the sea ice is forming later and melting earlier, it's not going to have as much snow drifted on top of it. Early in the winter, the snow is going to fall into the ocean and dissolve rather than building up on the surface of the ice. So one of the suspected impacts that could befall ring seals is that there'll be too little ice, or too little snow, rather, on top of the ice for them to create these little caves. And if the seals are born, if the pups are born out on the surface, they're not only more vulnerable to polar bears, but they're vulnerable to Arctic foxes, they're vulnerable to gulls and ravens and other predators that that might be in the area. So, you know, the impact on the melting sea ice is not just about polar bears. It's about the whole ecosystem.
Right. Well, thank you for the question, James. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Richard in San Mateo. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Hey, thank you so much. Hi, Dr. Stephen. I want to thank you so much because I feel this information, as you said, it's integrated into our own, you know, climate crisis. And by empowering us to have these conversations and make changes that seem small in our own lives, but really can affect a great transformation in our society. What it comes down to is stewardship or domination. And I appreciate you giving us a way to affect change to 50 years from 50 years. in our lives. And I'm going to keep listening, but I wanted to thank you for that, because I've been, it's been on my heart of how do we bridge our conversation from the dominant idea to the community again. And this information really empowers me to do that, and I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you so much for the comment.
Thank you so much for calling in, Richard. You know, to that point, Dr. Amstrup, in many ways, we know what we need to do. I mean, we've been talking about these issues for so long. And after the election, we knew that the media would be focusing on the tweets and the scandal of the day, which, you know, sometimes that is important. But we knew that the climate crisis wouldn't get the attention it deserves. And with COVID, so much of our attention is on that. And we were dedicated to really discussing these issues every Monday. What are your thoughts about, you know, what's at stake? I hear you when you say vote. And to that point, it's so important for everyone to check their voter registration to make sure it's right, to vote as early as possible so we don't have problems with the mail system. But we have a few emails from listeners, Dr. Amstrup, who say, you know, with the Republicans in Congress who are, you know, climate deniers, this is one of the sole reasons that we can't take action about this issue. So we've got an election coming up. What are your thoughts about what's at stake with this election?
Well, it's what's at stake is huge. It's basically our future. And, you know, it's interesting to me. You bring up the fact that many politicians and that this has become very partisan. It seems to be a Republican Party issue, disbelieving or at least claiming to not believe in global warming and the associated climate changes. But, you know, global warming is caused or is a result of the laws of physics. We've known for about 150 years that if we add more CO2 to the atmosphere, the world has to warm. And we can't just pick and choose which laws of physics we are going to follow. And it baffles me that people are able to get away with saying, oh, I don't believe. Well, this isn't really about belief unless you choose not to believe the laws of physics. And in that case, I guess you wouldn't be concerned about tripping when you're going down the stairs because you wouldn't fall down. You know, if we, you know, it's quite interesting to me that we could have people somehow thinking that they can get on a jet airplane reliant on the laws of physics to travel across the country, but that they won't trust those same laws of physics when it comes to the warming of our atmosphere. The bottom line, though, is that we do need to change the composition of the Congress to people who really take this seriously, who actually believe evidence instead of strongly held beliefs. You know, many of, I think, in our Congress now are so handicapped by their strongly held beliefs that they can't even look at the evidence or won't look at the evidence. But this is not about Republicans or Democrats or independents or anybody else. This is about all of us. And the sooner that our leaders get that understanding into their heads, the better. And you mentioned the coronavirus situation, and I think there's a really great example there. The countries that actually took the evidence seriously early on are the countries that are faring most favorably from this. Even some of the countries that were hit very hard early on, when they realized, oh, my God, this really is a problem, and started to take action seriously, they are doing better now. I mean, look at Italy. You know, they were really hard hit early on, but now they're largely back to normal, except that when people are in public or among other people that they don't know, they wear masks. But otherwise, they're largely back to normal. And where are we? We're floundering around here due to a lack of really honest leadership. And so we need that leadership, and the only way we can really get it in our society is by voting.
Well, Dr. Emstrup, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for all that you do for the polar bears, and we'd love to have you back.
It'd be great to be back in another conversation. I do want to mention, if I've got time, that it's really unfortunate that Dr. Molnar wasn't able to join us. He built the model that allowed us to project how many ice-free days polar bears can sustain. And it was that fundamental outcome that allowed us to make these kinds of projections. So, we have to make sure that he gets his full credit on this. And I'm really sorry he wasn't able to join us.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure he's okay, but for some reason we just couldn't connect with him. But we'll definitely have him on a future show. So thank you so much.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you a lot for having me. And I do look forward to another conversation sometime.
Great. Thank you. Likewise. Dr. Stephen Emstrup is chief scientist for Polar Bears International. It's the only organization dedicated to wild polar bears. Dr. Emstrup is also adjunct professor at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. Find more stories. You can also read the study about polar bears at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the U.S. Census. The Trump administration has said it will remove undocumented immigrants from the headcount, and the census said it would cut back counting by a month. The Brennan Center says these changes could cause California and New Jersey to lose a seat in the House. Undercounting people of color would have long-lasting effects in communities across the country. What will it take to ensure everyone is counted? That's the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and Hugh.